Let's start with the topic of today. There's one special thing. I'm going to discuss Walter Benjamin, a German Jewish philosopher today. But after the podcast, I also want you to watch a documentary. The documentary is called Ways of Seeing. It's by John Berger. It's who was an English writer and documentary maker. It's quite old. It's from 1972, so it's man, it's almost 50 years old. It looks really dated. The clothing and the kind of clips that you will see, it looks really dated. But the message, the statement made by the documentary is so strong that I really would like to ask you to view it. I will provide a link on Digitap for you to see it. It's only 30 minutes and it's terrific. It's really a way of doing philosophy in a different way, to do philosophy in an audio-visual way. I really like it a lot. So please watch it after you've listened to this podcast. Okay, let's get started then. So last week I talked to you about the futurists, and you will recall that I gave numerous examples of their strategy of provocation. The futurists were as violent, as shocking as possible in their statements, in their manifestos, and also in their artworks. Something important from last week's session that I want to recap today is that the emergence of the futurists demonstrates that the transition from the 19th to the 20th century is actually a rupture. It's a break. For the first time, the historical awareness of artists has become so strong that the past is seen as a threat to the present. From the perspective of the philosophy of art, futurism is important because it advocates, for the first time ever, an aesthetic of rupture, not a continuity with the past, not an aesthetic of continuity, an aesthetic of rupture. The radicalism of the avant-garde created a stir at the beginning of the 20th century. The proposals of the futurists and other avant-garde artists were rash and drastic. They called into question the whole system of art. Think, for instance, of the inverted urinal submitted by Marcel Duchamp for an exhibition in New York in 1917, which he signed with the pseudonym R. Mutt and gave the title Fountain. It's a ready-made sculpture, you'll obviously know it. It's a very famous work of art. It was submitted for an exhibition organized by the Society of Independent Artists, and in Duchamp's presentation, the urinal's orientation was altered from its usual positioning. So he turned it on its side, he rotated it 90 degrees. It's important to know that Fountain was not officially rejected by the committee of the Society of Independent Artists, because the society rules stated that all works would be accepted from artists who paid the fee. But the work was never shown, it was never placed in the show area. So, as Duchamp himself put it, the work was suppressed. It was not officially censured, but it was suppressed. It's useful to point out that the work is often seen as a criticism of the art world, but actually Duchamp himself was very much part of that art world. At the time, he was a board member himself of the Society of Independent Artists, but most of the other board members did not realize this, did not notice that he was the author of the work because he used a pseudonym. There was much debate by the board members about whether the piece was or was not an artwork. The conclusion of the debate was to hide Fountain from view during the show. The committee wrote, and I quote, "Fountain may be a very useful object in its place, but its place is not an art exhibition, and it is by definition not a work of art." Following that removal, Fountain was photographed at the photographic studio of Alfred Stieglitz, and that photo was published in The Blind Man. The Blind Man was a New York Dada periodical. It is this picture that has since become famous because the original of the sculpture has actually been lost. Duchamp later did make a number of replicas of the work, and these replicas were also on exhibition in various museums around the world. In the Dada publication, where it was first shown, the work is defended on the following grounds, and I quote, Whether Mr. Mutt, with his own hands, made the fountain or not has no importance. He chose it. He took an ordinary article of life, placed it so that its useful significance disappeared under the new title and point of view. He created a new thought for that object. End of quote. So you see that here for the first time, we find a theory of art that says an object is a work of art if it is called a work of art by the artist. This is obviously something new in the history of art. Before Duchamp, before Fountain, a work of art could be identified as such because it conformed to some formal characteristics of what a work of art should be, how it should be produced, for instance. And now this was no longer the case. We will come back to this actually in next year's course, to this theory, the institutional theory of art. But now I will move on. Now, some scholars, I want to point this out. Some scholars have suggested that the original work was by an unidentified female artist who had submitted it to her friend, Duchamp. But the consensus today is that historians generally believe that Duchamp was solely responsible for the presentation of Fountain. So, what do we conclude from this example? If a work such as Fountain was possible, is it not that all predominant expectations about art had now been shattered? Had not every standard, every norm, every taste become relative? The avant-garde actually were an expression of cultural pessimism and also themselves gave rise to further cultural pessimism. In 1896, the Irish poet William Butler Yeats attended the opening night of the first avant-garde theatre play, which is Ubu Roi, King Ubu, by Alfred Jarry, a French theatre director and poet and writer. For those of you who don't know this play, Ubu Roi, it's famous for some of the same reasons as The Fountain by Duchamp. It's a theatre play where the first line spoken on stage is the word merdre. Merdre in French is a slight modification of the word merde, and that's French for shit. So, oh my god, I said the S word. In an official Royal Academy of Fine Arts podcast, whatever will happen now. So, it's the same kind of shock effect here that we find in Ubu Roi as in the case of Fountain. You associate a high-minded domain, the fine arts or the theater, with a low-level topic, urinating or defecating. So when William Yeats saw Ubu Roi and then got back in his room, he wrote that the delicate poetry of his own generation of poets, that of the symbolist poets, had already met its demise, was already coming to an end. And then he wrote, "After us, the savage god," end of quote. Everything had now become possible. That's the value, that's the deeper meaning of the intervention of the avant-garde artists. Everything is now possible. That a break had to be made was obvious to the avant-garde artists themselves, to the futurists, and to the Dadaists or the Surrealists. But how art would look like after that moment remained an open question. What will you do now that everything has become possible? In any case, it was obvious that new technology would play a significant role. And a typical example is a book designed from 1928 by the futurist artist Ivo Panaggi, which I already discussed in last week's podcast. It's a photo collage for which Panaggi made for a book cover. It shows an enormous red arrow piercing an ancient Greek amphitheater. And it's no coincidence that the book's title is L'Antiteatro, the anti-theater. The text is not an indictment of the current state of theater in Italy. It's a book about film. And what you see in the design of Panaggi is this belief that technology will change the arts from within. This is a message which we got very clearly from the futurists. The arts should change. They cannot remain just architecture, just painting, just literature. In this new world, in this industrialized world, in this military world, in this mechanized world of today, this urbanized world, art should become something totally different. Art can no longer be this mere beautification, this mere golden shine that you put on top of things. Art has to become something else quite entirely. For the futurists, for instance, photography was a part of that new art, or film. It was a medium that embodied the future. Still, a thorough reflection on the specificity of these new media is not to be found in the writings of the futurists. This had to wait until 1936, when the German Jewish philosopher and art critic Walter Benjamin published a compelling essay on old media and new media. Let me tell you something about Benjamin first. Walter Benjamin came from the Jewish upper class of Berlin. During the interwar period, he often stayed in Paris, initially in the context of his research on the city's 19th century cultural history, but later also as a political refugee. His Jewish roots, as well as his communist sympathies, made life precarious under the emerging Nazi regime in Germany. The title of Benjamin's essay contains all the questions he wanted to answer. It's called Das Kunstwerk im Zeitalter seiner technischen Reproduzierbarkeit, or in English, The Work of Art in the Age of its Technological Reproducibility. And this is Benjamin's central question. What has changed in the artwork itself and in our interactions with it when it has become so much easier to reproduce art through photographs, films, or print? Now, the easy answer is, of course, nothing has changed because it's just a reproduction, it's just a copy. Now, Benjamin thinks it's more than that. Something has really changed because of the enormously increased availability of the works of art. The starting point of the essay is that works of art have always been reproducible to a limited extent. That's the important point. In ancient times, for example, artworks were copied in the form of castings. But the speed and ease of reproduction have increased tremendously since the invention of lithography at the end of the 18th century. Moreover, the difference was so dramatic that it was not merely a quantitative but a qualitative leap. Lithography made it possible to reproduce images almost as quickly as texts. The modern cartoon, for instance, has been made possible through that technology. Of course, you can argue here that we also have caricatures and satirical images from earlier periods. For instance, in the Napoleonic period, early 19th century, many satirical images making fun of the church or of political enemies were published. But if you had created a cartoon as an artist in this period, late 18th, early 19th century, when lithography was not yet available, widely available as a technology, and you wanted to publish your caricature, you were dependent on an engraver and a printer for making a copper engraving or etching the image and then making a print. This was an expensive procedure. You would not do it for any image whatsoever. Someone had to believe in your work. Someone had to find it, to believe in the success, possible success of the satire or the caricature in order to take the trouble to make an engraving and to print it. Lithography, while still quite labor-intensive, made everything much easier and faster and cheaper. So lithographs of satirical images were available to accompany and illustrate news reports in the mass media. That was not yet possible before. The illustrated school textbooks also owed their rise to lithography. And another such leap took place a few decades later with the invention of photography. Technical reproduction, furthermore, made the copy more independent of the original. Firstly, photographic reproduction, for example through magnification, revealed things that were difficult to see in the original. And secondly, photographs could bring the work into situations inaccessible through the original. In order to see a famous painting, it was no longer necessary to visit a particular church or museum. The viewer could study it in the reading room of the library, or even in his own living room if he bought the book containing the reproductions. Now, Benjamin points out that a reproduction not only implies a huge step forward, it also implies a great loss. And this is a big point in Benjamin's essay, the loss of aura. In spite of the increase in possibilities, something also disappears during reproduction. What? Well, this is something that more specifically Benjamin names the aura. He defines it as the here and now of the work of art. That's a quote. One of the main aspects that are lost is the original context. Many examples of Western art were produced for a religious, namely a Christian context. And this work was very specifically intended to function in that context, for instance, in a church or in a chapel. When a reproduction, photograph or a lithograph isolates the work from that context, a number of opportunities for appreciation and interpretation are changed or sometimes even eliminated. For instance, take the fresco cycle by the Italian 13th century artist Giotto, located in the Scrovegni Chapel in Padua, north of Italy. You can go there and watch the paintings for yourself, in that space, standing in the chapel, or you can watch a reproduction. You can look up the paintings on Wikipedia, you can watch pictures of them in an art history book. And those are two very distinct and very different experiences. Examining a photograph of the Scrovegni Chapel frescoes in an art book is a different experience than being physically surrounded by the frescoes in the actual chapel. Let me give another example to make it, I hope, even more clear. Let's take the famous sculpture, The Ecstasy of Saint Teresa. It's a sculpture. It's located in the Santa Maria della Vittoria Church in Rome. It's a very famous Baroque work of sculpture from 1647, sculpted by Gian Lorenzo Bernini. And the sculpture is most well known in the form of the shape and the expression on the face of Saint Teresa. It's called The Ecstasy of Saint Teresa. And how the work is mostly presented, is in the form of a close up of the face of Saint Teresa, and that's indeed is a magnificently successful sculpted face of a young woman in the throes of ecstasy, which, however, does not really correspond to the actual experience of seeing the sculpture, because that's just a close-up of her face. If you go to the church, if you go to the Santa Maria della Vittoria, you have a totally different experience. First of all, it's a sculpture not just of the face of Saint Teresa, but of her full body, and also of a second figure. There's an angel who pierces her heart with an arrow, and that symbolizes the visions she receives. So the ecstasy of Saint Teresa is a religious ecstasy. She has visions of Christ, and the angel piercing her heart with the arrow symbolizes those visions. That's not all. It's a work. It's an altarpiece, so it takes center stage behind the altar in the church. But on the sides, there's more. So the work is not just these two figures. There's also various other figures standing, not really standing, sitting, like in the theater box on both sides of the church. They're watching the scene. They're watching the angel and Teresa. And these figures were actually the depictions of the people who had paid for the work. So that's something that, as a visitor, as a spectator, you also take into account. You experience, when you enter the church, you experience not just the sculpture, not just the face of Saint Teresa. That's, of course, the focal point. It's the focus of the sculpture. But you take in all of it. You take in the full context, which is obviously a religious context, which is a context of wealth, which is a context of rich patrons having paid for this work depicting the ecstasy of Saint Teresa. All of this is abstracted away when you look at just a close-up of the face of Saint Teresa, which means that you can also start using that image in different contexts where it gets a totally different meaning. A very well-known example is that this image, for instance, has been used on the cover of some editions of a book by Georges Bataille, a French philosopher. He wrote a book on the philosophy of eroticism. And there, the face of Saint Teresa is used as a cover image, of course, with the suggestion that the ecstasy of Saint Teresa is not merely religious ecstasy, but also sexual ecstasy, which is a totally different meaning. That meaning is possible because you abstract away the religious context of the work, which you cannot abstract away if you actually visit the church yourself and you're there physically as a visitor present in that church. So the emergence of new possibilities for reproduction result in a change in our perception itself. Technology modifies the way we are in the world. And according to Benjamin, becoming aware of that is the true meaning of avant-garde art. The avant-garde not merely represents a new style in art history. That would be the easy way out. That's the art historical approach, to reduce Dadaism or Surrealism or Futurism to just a new set of techniques that artists started to use, or a new content matter that they're depicting in their works. No, Benjamin says, that's not the true meaning of the avant-garde. The avant-garde's appearance demonstrates that new media have fragmented our perception of reality. He's specifically thinking of Cubist art, of Futurist paintings, of Surrealist and Dadaist art. Think, for instance, of paintings such as The Dynamics of a Dog on a Leash. This is a very famous painting by the Futurist artist Giacomo Balla. It's a painting I've included in the slides. Please have a look at it. I think it's a brilliant painting, where you see all the different movements that the dog is making on a leash, but you see them all represented at the same time. So it's a very dynamic painting, although it's a static image. Or you can, of course, think of famous Cubist paintings such as Demoiselle d'Avignon, which also tries to represent a new way of perceiving reality in a painting, in a traditional two-dimensional image. According to Walter Benjamin, avant-garde art was a translation of the experiences of the contemporary city dweller. That experience was an experience of being bombarded by visual and verbal messages coming from billboards, newspapers, magazines, radio, photographs, and film. At first sight, the translation made of that experience by avant-garde artists was a surprise to most of contemporary spectators and readers. Well-thinking citizens were flabbergasted when they were first confronted with the ready-mades, with the collages, with the assemblage objects, with the disrupted compositions of avant-garde art. But the main message, Benjamin explained, was that a change had occurred in our perception. The avant-garde showed that the future of art as a whole was at stake. He writes, and I quote, "It has always been one of the primary tasks of art to create a demand whose hour of full satisfaction has not yet come." End of quote. As the art of the 20th and 21st centuries would demonstrate, the future had never been so open. Let me conclude this podcast by reading an extensive fragment of Benjamin's essay to you. "Noch bei der höchst vollendeten Reproduktion fällt eines aus, das Hier und Jetzt des Kunstwerks, sein einmaliges Dasein an dem Orte, an dem es sich befindet." No, don't worry, I'm not going to read you the entire thing in German. I would like to. It's beautiful, but I'm not going to do that, obviously. I'm going to quote a sentence here and there in German because it's so accurate. But, of course, I'm going to read it in English. "In even the most perfect reproduction, one thing is lacking. The here and now of the work of art, its unique existence in a particular place. It is this unique existence and nothing else that bears the mark of the history to which the work has been subject. This history includes changes to the physical structure of the work over time, together with any changes in ownership. Traces of the former can be detected only by chemical or physical analysis, which cannot be performed on a reproduction, while changes of ownership are part of a tradition, which can be traced only from the standpoint of the original in its present location. The here and now of the original underlies the concept of its authenticity, and on the latter in turn is founded the idea of a tradition which has passed the object down as the same, identical thing to the present day. The whole sphere of authenticity eludes technological reproduction. This is an important one. Der gesamte Bereich der Echtheit entzieht sich der technischen Reproduzierbarkeit. But whereas the authentic work retains its full authority in the face of reproduction made by hand, this is not the case with technological reproduction. The reason is twofold. First, technological reproduction is more independent of the original than is manual reproduction. For example, in photography, it can bring out aspects of the original that are accessible only to the lens, which is adjustable and can easily change viewpoint, but not to the human eye. Or it can use certain processes, such as enlargement or slow motion, to record images which escape natural optics altogether. This is the first reason. Second, technological reproduction can place the copy of the original in situations where the original itself cannot attain. Above all, it enables the original to meet the recipient halfway, whether in the form of a photograph or in that of a gramophone record. The cathedral leaves its site to be received in the studio of an art lover. The choral work, performed in an auditorium or in the open air, is enjoyed in a private room. These changed circumstances may leave the artwork's other properties untouched, but they certainly devalue the here and now of the artwork. And although this can apply not only to art, but, say, to a landscape moving past a spectator in a film, in the work of art this process touches on a highly sensitive core, more vulnerable than that of any natural object. That core is its authenticity. One might focus these aspects of the artwork in the concept of the aura and go on to say, what withers in the age of the technological reproducibility of the work of art is the latter's aura. I'm going to say this again because it's important. What withers or disappears in the age of the technological reproducibility of the work of art is the work of art's aura. This process is symptomatic. Its significance extends far beyond the realm of art. It might be stated as a general formula that the technology of reproduction detaches the reproduced object from the sphere of tradition. By replicating the work many times over, it substitutes a mass existence for a unique existence. And in permitting the reproduction to reach the recipient in his or her own situation, it actualizes that which is reproduced. Just as the entire mode of existence of human collectives changes over long historical periods, so does their mode of perception. The way in which human perception is organized, the medium in which it occurs, is conditioned not only by nature, but by history. End of quote. Now I'm going to skip a few of the intervening paragraphs and I'll move to a different section of Benjamin's essay, which is about the comparison between filming and painting. In what sense is a filmmaker or a camera operator different from a painter? And I quote again. Here we have to pose the question, how does the camera operator compare with a painter? The painter maintains in his work a natural distance from reality, whereas the cinematographer penetrates deeply into its tissue. The images obtained by each differ enormously. The painter's is a total image, whereas that of the cinematographer is piecemeal, its manifold parts being assembled according to a new law. The most important social function of film is to establish equilibrium between human beings and the apparatus. Film achieves its goal not only in terms of man's presentation of himself to the camera, but also in terms of his representation of his environment by means of his apparatus. On the one hand, film furthers insight into the necessities governing our lives by its use of close-ups, by its accentuation of hidden details in familiar objects, and by its exploration of commonplace milieus through the ingenious guidance of the camera. On the other hand, it manages to assure us of a vast and unsuspected field of action. our bars and city streets, our offices and furnished rooms, our railroad stations and our factories seemed to close relentlessly around us. Then came film and exploded this prison world with the dynamite of the split second, so that now we can set off calmly on journeys of adventure among its far-flung debris. With the close-up, space expands. With slow motion, movement is extended. And just as enlargement not merely clarifies what we see distinctly in any case, but brings to light entirely new structures of matter, slow motion not only reveals familiar aspects of movement, but discloses quite unknown aspects within them. Aspects which do not appear as the retarding natural movements, but have a curious gliding, floating character of their own. Clearly, it is another nature which speaks to the camera as compared to the eye. Other above all in the sense that the space informed by human consciousness gives way to a space informed by the unconscious. Whereas it is a commonplace that, for example, we have some idea what is involved in the act of walking, if only in very general terms, we have no idea at all what happens during the split second when a person actually takes a step. We are familiar with the movement of picking up a cigarette lighter or a spoon, but we know almost nothing of what really goes on between hand and metal, and still less how this varies with different moods. This is where the camera comes into play, with all its resources for swooping and rising, disrupting and isolating, stretching or compressing a sequence, enlarging or reducing an object. It is through the camera that we first discover the optical unconscious, just as we discover the instinctual unconscious through psychoanalysis. It has always been one of the primary tasks of art to create a demand whose hour of full satisfaction has not yet come. The history of every art form has critical periods in which the particular form strains after effects which can be easily achieved only with a changed technical standards, that is to say, in a new art form. The excesses and crudities of art which thus result, particularly in periods of so-called decadence, actually emerge from the core of its richest historical energies. In recent years, Dadaism has amused itself with such barbarisms. Only now is its impulse recognizable. Dadaism attempted to produce, with the means of painting or literature, the effect which the public today seeks in film. End of quote. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening to the other podcasts as well. And please do not forget to watch the John Berger documentary after this. Thank you so much. Good luck with the juries. See you again.